In this episode, you're going to discover how entrepreneurs solve the live crime video problems, Snapchat's mobile partnership, Twitter's biggest nightmare, how to market to teens, and what's next now that YouTube has retired annotations. Hit it!
Discover how video can help you achieve your sales and marketing goals. It all starts right here in Todd Hartley's Video Marketing Mastery. Brought to you by Wirebuzz.
What is up? What is up? You know, Wirebuzz just got back from 3 days of nonstop buffets. Oh, and meetings, of course, in Vegas at the American Society of Breast Surgeons Conference. You may recall that after my stepmom was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2010-ish, Wirebuzz launched Breast Cancer Answers, which is now the largest library of breast cancer videos where experts are answering patient questions. And off the top of my head, I think we've got some 1,400-plus videos, over 10,000 video views, and 700,000 followers on social media. You know, like I do for patients whenever I'm at a medical conference, I get one of the world's leading rock stars to join me for a Facebook Live interview where they answer patient questions. And this time, the topic live from the conference was everything you need to know about lumpectomies. It's a real honor for me. My wife is also a survivor of breast cancer. And so I get an opportunity to pour my heart and soul into these interviews. And so we did that right from downstairs off of a webcam, or excuse me, off of my cell phone onto Facebook Live. And then in a private presidential suite, we had our video crew filming on the 30th floor a new interview every single hour for clients. And just a ton of content. And then downstairs, when I wasn't doing the Facebook Live event, Marcus Krieg, who you know from the podcast, our director of strategy, Jason Todd Fair, a lot of people don't know, he looks up to his boss so much, he even goes by Todd as his middle name. Jason Todd Fair and I met with clients or prospects every 30 minutes in Vegas. It was like crush mode, right? And while we were in crush mode, there were even a few times when the three of us would have to break up and hold our own meetings simultaneously. Mostly, our clients are trying to do very similar things. This is for the medical clients that are there at the conference. They're trying to film researchers explaining the results of their newest data. They're trying to capture key opinion leaders giving testimonials, peer-to-peer testimonials, right? And often these key opinion leaders who are the biggest rock stars in the world live somewhere else far, far away. They don't live in Vegas land. They're not Raider fans. And you have to get them in front of the camera wherever the conference is. And often it's so much cheaper to film while they happen to be in the building. So we seem to carve out time. Then we also film researchers explaining the results of their newest data. We capture key opinion leaders going over the diagnostic tests and what it means. Or we create overview videos about, let's say, a new device or something that's rolling out in the market. And maybe the last piece that most of them have is we're producing videos that the sales team can use to speed up their sales process. Look, it doesn't matter if it's the medical industry or it's travel or it's technology, it's SaaS or real estate or country clubs trying to sell memberships. There is a very consistent buyer's journey that people go through, very consistent ways to convince and convert. And as you pull people through the process, you realize that at their very core, people are people. We've learned from Facebook that people prefer video. Subsequent studies also back up that data. They're four times more likely to watch video than anything else. So times are changing. Video leveraged with the right video marketing strategy designed by digital strategists and executed by digital marketers is now the most powerful business tool in the world. And companies that are starting to leverage video right now are crushing their competition. Great time to be alive. And for me, my obsession with video as an optimized tool for sales started way back in 2003 when I was leading digital marketing for seven of the largest nationally syndicated talk shows in Hollywood. And each one of those shows had 20 to 30 million weekly listeners. And in the analytics, I saw a massive market signal. Video was getting 10 times the results of any of the other content that we created. People preferred video. And at that time, way back in 2003, I was sensitive enough to see the market signal. And so I planted my rockstar digital marketing flag in the video marketing space and kept innovating until the business world started noticing that video was getting the best results. Look, I want you to think back to another watershed moment in digital. The first time you heard of someone you knew that was closing their cable account and becoming a cord cutter, right? Can you remember back when the first person mentioned it to you? For me, it was Wirebuzz's director of strategy, Marcus Krieg. You know, he's been with me the longest here at Wirebuzz. We've had a great run together building this company. And I don't know if it was 3 years or 4 years ago when he told me that dude has never had a cable account in his entire life, okay? And he told me, because I asked him if he was going to watch a game, and he's a big sports fan, and he said, no, he's going to go to a bar because he doesn't have cable. And I thought, if you don't have cable, how do you watch your Oregon Ducks football team play on Saturday? Do you always go to a bar? And, you know, as if the only reason for having cable was to watch your team, right? And I remember that pretty clearly. I even slipped Marcus my cable account's online login information because I wanted to make sure that, you know, he didn't always have to run to the bar in order to see a game. And unbeknownst to most of us, right back there, 3 years or 4 years ago, something seismic was happening. Then we all started to hear more people cutting the cords and going online. The people were acting by the millions, and the market does what the market always does. The market doesn't give a f- if you're invested in television commercials or if you're invested in television shows. The market just adapts, which brings us right up to the present moment. This week, TechCrunch speculated that is Twitter the new television? The social network hopes to be airing live video content and programming 24 hours a day, 7 days a week via both its website and its app. Think about this. My God, Christo in the room with me. When I was a kid, dude, the TV turned off at midnight. You never lived through that. At midnight, you heard a dude, and then the Star Spangled Banner would play, and they'd show a waving American flag. And after the Star Spangled Banner, you'd get the color chart up, and it would just go until like 6 a.m. or something, right? That's when I was a kid, you knew it was time to go to bed, is when the national anthem came on. You turned it down because you didn't want your mom to hear that you were still up. Now, this brings me to the present moment. Live video has been an audience draw for Twitter. And some of its product efforts, including prominent placement of streaming content in the mobile app when available, and the introduction of Apple TV's app, and a primary focus on video, has helped get Twitter those eyeballs that Twitter desperately needed, and Twitter morphing into a cord-cutting alternative with 24-hour news and information on its channel peppered with unique events has big potential in terms of its ability to woo and keep prominent lucrative advertisers. Now, the main question now will be, can Twitter build a quality pipeline of content, of programs that fill the days, whether they can manage to do so before this huge onslaught shift that takes place to digital delivery models for traditional television service providers. And when it reaches its apex, Twitter needs to get there first. So what can an entrepreneur learn from this scenario? Well, I think it can be summed up in two words: be sensitive. Just be sensitive. Whenever people around you start doing something strange or different, you have to be sensitive enough to recognize the oddity of the moment. That new exodus or market transition, it should raise red flags in your mind to investigate further. You know, in my situation, instead of being curious and looking at the market changing moment, do you know what I did? I heckled Marcus. He was a cord cutter. Got to run to the bar to watch your game. You're going to put up your rabbit ears to see the game. Like, I heckled him. The customer entrepreneur inside of me had fallen asleep. I was paying double for fiber and cable. But if I was sensitive to the market signals that were all over my office, 60% of the people here at Wirebuzz are cord cutters. Maybe I could have launched a service servicing cord cutters instead of just heckling them, right? That's a fail on me. I own that. And in our lives, there are only so many massive market fluctuations that we will ever see. And Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, dude, they are all in the hunt right now. What about you? Did you create a business that serviced cord cutters? It's a huge group. They've got a ton of money and they want to spend money on a company that's going to help them best solve their needs. If not, keep your feelers out. Another market shift in an industry or another one might be happening right now, but you're only going to notice it if you're sensitive. So be sensitive. All right, so let's talk about violence in streaming video on social media. Each week, we've discussed together this developing problem. And this week, I read in Fortune magazine, companies sensitive to the problem of grisly murders and mayhem going viral on social media. Well, they're racing to improve the artificial intelligence software that can automatically spot and block these types of videos. That's how entrepreneurs in the free market system solve problems. So instead of going off to see the wizard in the big Emerald City and begging him to solve our problem with some kind of legislation, entrepreneurs innovate and solve problems each and every day. Reading from that Fortune article, you may recall hearing a Thai man who broadcast himself killing his 11-month-old daughter. Horrible story, and he did it live in live video on Facebook this week. That's the latest in a string of horrific, violent crimes that are shown on Facebook. Now, this incident and numerous others have prompted questions about how Facebook's reporting system works and how violent content can be flagged at faster rates. Being sensitive enough to react to this developing problem, a dozen or more companies are wrestling with it. Those in the industry say Google, which faces similar problems with its YouTube service, and Facebook are working on their own solutions right now. And you can read that full article on the show notes page, which I'll give you in a few moments. Now, in past episodes, I've shared with you how Twitter was rapidly morphing into a video ad-based revenue model, and it was doing that to save its struggling network. I shared how Twitter had really, in a very smart, strategic way, recognized its fastest revenue-generating opportunity with the path to least resistance was to start running 30-second TV commercials in their feed. Why? Because those commercials, they were already created. Advertisers with money already had those commercials in the can. They didn't have to go out and develop some kind of odd dimension like Instagram video shape. You know, they didn't have to go and hire somebody to create it. The commercials would already fit on Twitter. And that's because Twitter didn't come up with something cheeky for their brand like 140-second ad or 14.0-second ads, right? A lot of businesses make that mistake. Instead, Twitter used what I call business Aikido. Do you know what that is? A business that practices Aikido, well, they negate their opponent's power. In this case, their opponents, Twitter's opponent, are traditional TV networks selling ad space. And we're going to see in coming episodes how advertisers react and take Twitter out on a first date and eventually migrate some of their ad spend over to Twitter, right? That is a super important opportunity. They use the path to least resistance because they needed to increase adoption. Adoption's the most important element. Now, check this out. Since we last spoke, I saw an article in Forbes that explained that Twitter's quarterly user growth, because it's starting to see some growth, it can be attributed to new and resurrected users. following more news and political accounts in the U.S., suggesting that the site may be receiving more interest in the wake of the Donald Trump presidency. You know, Twitter saw an acceleration in their daily activity users in the fourth quarter of last year, up 14% year over year. In a nutshell, Twitter's biggest nightmare has come true. The guy who Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey had hoped to silence, Donald Trump, is now the best thing to ever happen to Twitter since Kim Kardashian. eMarketer's principal analyst Deborah Williamson explained, quote, "With 1.6% growth in ad revenue expected this year, Twitter's business is essentially stalled." Quote, "The recent launch of in-stream video ads will help, but the lack of meaningful growth in usage is weighing heavily on Twitter's revenue. However, Twitter remains an important place for businesses to conduct customer service and distribute vital corporate information, and it's still the place for real-time discussion of news and events." There's nothing more fun for me than, oh my God, I sound like such a loser when I say it that way. Like, this is the most fun I could ever have. But the reality is, it's pretty damn fun to watch a live event, a sporting event, or to watch a presidential State of the Union or a debate, and to have searched the hashtag for that event and just listen to people read the really funny comments that people are making in real time. Super cool. Basically, by adopting that 30-second television commercial, Twitter removed the one weapon that traditional advertisers or traditional television had over Twitter, and that was ad dollars. You know, throughout my traditional and digital marketing career, I've discovered adoption. Adoption is the hardest, highest hurdle for a project's success. Whenever you're trying to build a new product or a service, prioritize adoption, especially if you're a market challenger. Whenever possible, dig deep, use business Akito, and you're going to find that you're going to scale quicker. It's going to be a whole lot of fun to see Twitter's video ad strategy and to see if it pays off or not. Stay tuned. I'll keep you up to speed as this story unfolds. By the way, I love when I get to quote a news source that quotes a news source. So here goes. Mashable explained this week how Bloomberg has agreed to produce exclusive TV content for Twitter that'll play 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. More programming from Bloomberg is never a good idea. The announcement comes just ahead of Twitter's first ever New Fronts, where the tech company will pitch advertisers on a slate of original programming that they can advertise within for the upcoming year. Think about these. They usually are called upfronts in traditional media, where advertisers all get together for a big conference and they get to meet everybody in the lineup for NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox, right? And advertisers can go in and bid and secure placement on some of these new programs and series that are back on TV. So what's Bloomberg going to air on Twitter, right? Well, Bloomberg Media CEO Justin Smith explained it's going to be focused on the most important news for an intelligent audience around the globe, and it's going to be broader in focus than our existing network. Twitter's biggest value is immediate access to people during a developing story. Like, we saw it when it was so relevant when Osama bin Laden was killed, and we saw it unfold, and the people locally in Pakistan that were commenting in real time as it was happening was just downright remarkable. And it severs really the news desk or the news editor from that and goes directly from people to people sharing real time news. And Twitter sees it catering to junkies for the financial news and sports as being an enormous draw on Twitter. It's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out. You know, I think the big takeaway here is it's really important for Twitter to have recognized who their most dominant users are for real-time access to information, and that is in the financial sector and also in sports. And if you know anything about this, you're really looking for these types of industries that have new news and information each and every day. Financial, right? What happened today is old tomorrow. a reason to come back. And sports is exactly the same way. And let's not forget about the little brother Snapchat, which Axios reported, quote, Snapchat has launched over a dozen exclusive mobile partnerships this year, many of which are with TV networks, hoping to reach millennials who are cutting the cord. Now, by comparison, Facebook and Twitter have been slow to win over publishers for exclusive video deals, focusing instead on pursuing live streaming contracts, particularly in sports and in entertainment. Now, why does this matter? Well, Snapchat can't stop Facebook from copying its features, right? We talked about that last week. And Snapchat can't stop Facebook from eating its stories audience. So the self-proclaimed camera company is setting itself up to beat Facebook in the content game. Specifically, Snap is hoping to capture a piece of the roughly 70 billion US TV and ad market. You want to read this article on Axios? It'll be on the show notes page. It's pretty damn cool where all this is headed. If your business needs to know where young people are spending their time, well, this Business Insider report is for you. Quote, teens watch about twice as much Netflix as live TV, right? And what do they watch even more than Netflix? They watch YouTube. On average, teens spend 34% of their video time watching YouTube compared to 27% watching Netflix and 14% of their time watching live TV. Now, this puts YouTube and Netflix way ahead of their streaming competitors. Hulu and Amazon came in at 4% and 3% respectively. Only 14% of teens are watching television. You got it? So if you're trying to sell anything to teens, resist the temptation to use your 1990 tricks and start targeting them where they are with video ads on YouTube. And that's where you and I intersect right here at Wirebuzz. If you want to know how to crush it with teens, you should be thinking about how to engage teens by leveraging YouTube influencers. Now, according to Mark Fiedelman, also known by his friends as Mark, don't put him in the Fiedelman position. He wrote in Entrepreneur Magazine that influencer marketing becomes a powerful solution that offers really high ROI, has an incredibly long shelf life, and conveys massive credibility. In fact, 92% of consumers trust influencer endorsements more than typical advertisements, all right? So YouTube influencers have reached their level of acclaim by promoting themselves in a super authentic manner. People watch them because they say and do as they please. How liberating is that, right? Now, your budget will largely dictate the size and the number of influencers that you can recruit. Acquisition costs fluctuate significantly depending on YouTubers' reach, audience engagement, the niche, the sponsorship type, and really many other factors. Now, generally speaking, integrated video sponsorships should range somewhere between 4 cents to 7 cents per view, right? That's the cost per view, the CPV. Whereas dedicated videos land somewhere at about 8 cents to 15 cents CPV. If you want to learn more about this, a really great article in entrepreneur.com, you can find it on the show notes page. All right, when talking about YouTube, it's important to point out that an important article in the Vidyard blog appeared last week about featuring John Spenceley, who I know. I read John's articles in the Vidyard blog regularly when Vidyard had me come up to their Viewtopia and do a presentation and interview the rock stars at Salesforce.com live on stage in front of the audience. I ran into John before I went up and spoke, and I'm a nerd boy. So like when I saw John and his, he's kind of got an interesting, beard in the way that he's groomed that thing. It was really easy for me to see him, but more importantly, I was kind of excited to meet somebody that I've been reading for a while. So I kind of fanboyed. I know I took a photo with him. If I can find access to that photo, I'll put it on the show notes page. But John writes, YouTube is retiring annotations in favor of newer, more mobile-friendly call to action. The reason is YouTube annotations have never worked on mobile. As The company points out 60% of YouTube's watch time is now on mobile devices. YouTube's going to be focusing on perfecting end screens and cards, which can be created for a variety of purposes, including linking to a video or a playlist, promoting a channel, soliciting a donation, offering a poll question, or simply linking to an approved website. End screens give viewers who engage with your content all the way to the end of your video the opportunity to discover more content and follow through on the call to action. And to talk about this new development coming out of YouTube, I'm joined right now by John Spensley from Vidyard Blog. Hey, John.
Hey, Todd. How's it going?
You know, John, I loved this article that appeared in the Vidyard blog titled YouTube Ditches Annotations and Welcomes New Mobile-Friendly Interactivity. Nicely done. I think the key here is that 60% of YouTubers watch video on mobile devices and annotations weren't mobile-friendly. Is that the real reason behind this?
I think it's twofold. I think that's the main reason why YouTube wanted to roll out something new. I mean, annotations were really innovative at the time when they launched them several years ago. I think it's been 10 years. Yep. I'm trying to think of the beginning of the post. But yeah, so 10 years ago when they launched annotations, I mean, no one was doing call to actions in video unless you were just having that video automatically redirect you to somewhere else. So really, really innovative and great at the time. But the technology behind them hadn't caught up with the technology behind YouTube and with consumer behavior. So, you know, we had to think of the fact that if 60% of people are watching videos on mobile and marketers are using annotations as a way to drive people back to a landing page or back to their website, 60% of their audience could potentially be completely missing out on that. Now, that is 60% of overall videos. That includes all the B2C videos, all the video game reviews, all that kind of fun stuff. So from the B2B side, those numbers may have been quite different. We don't really have any way of knowing that. That's kind of locked within YouTube's data. But overall, 60% of your audience could potentially be missing out on your calls to action. And I think the other side of it is just that annotations were starting to show their age. You know, in a world where interactive video is quite common, in a world where, you know, you can add really complex and very pretty overlays to your video to link off to other content, you know, annotations were these little speech bubbles that would pop up at the bottom. They would obstruct your ability to view the video. They made a lot of sense at the time when that sort of technology was super limited, but, you know, as our capacity to display that kind of information has grown, as the technology has grown, annotations just hadn't really kept up. So I think cards and end screens are really YouTube's way of modernizing their platform and making it so that it's a little bit more with the times and in line with people what people were looking for.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, the times they are a-changing, and nothing changes faster than technology and our adoption. Quoting from your article, you write, YouTube has listened to its audience, and with the demise of annotations, we see a bigger effort put forward, perfecting end screens and cards, YouTube's new interactive elements. Let's talk about end screens. We'll spend a few moments about cards. What should people know about end screens?
So end screens are essentially your final CTA. So they're kind of your gift to whoever watches all the way to the end of the video. They are a way to direct people to different content through your website. They're a way to direct people towards videos on your site or towards your channel. I think to me the most important thing about end screens, though, is they really change them in a way that makes them work in YouTube's favor. And they did that by making it so that if you're going to have an end screen, at least one of the assets that you display has to either be a link to a channel, a link to one of your video playlists, or a link to a video. And to me, that's fine, but what frustrates me a little bit about it is that you can link to a content asset, but that content asset link is always going to be smaller in terms of screen space that it occupies than the video links that go on to other content. And YouTube, I think, did this because they want to keep people on YouTube. That's really the objective. When it comes to advertising revenue, when it comes to time on site, when it comes to eyes on videos, they want to keep you there, and they want to make sure that you're watching more content. And you could argue it's sort of a Netflix-type thing. If you finish a series on Netflix, if you finish an episode on Netflix, they're going to automatically start the next one.
But
if you finish an entire series, exactly. If you finish an entire series, though, they're going to automatically try and route you to a new one that they think is interesting. And so what YouTube has been doing that already, but in this case, they want to try and, I guess, give you a bit of control over what they route the person to next. But it is definitely a step up. I mean, a lot of times people were building that kind of content into the video itself and then using those sort of invisible annotations to link people off to it. So you'd see end screens that people had actually cooked into the video where it's like, go check out my channel. And the work is all on the video editor's end. I like that YouTube has made that a little bit easier. You can make your end screen of the video a little bit more generic and then just take advantage of these visual elements that YouTube's put together. But again, I do caution, you know, they're always going to make you link off to another people or another piece of content on YouTube if you are using them. Now, that limitation doesn't apply to cards, thankfully, and those you can kind of include wherever. But I love end screens. I get why YouTube did it. I think it's a little crappy from an interface perspective, especially if you just want the final call to action to be go check out the white paper or, you know, the demo that we just talked about. But I understand why they did it. You know, YouTube's investment in this is they want to make sure they get as many eyes on video content as they can. So even though I don't like it, I'm not surprised by it, I guess.
Right. And then we've got YouTube cards. You know, cards are visible during video playback. What do you want people to know about cards, John?
So cards are kind of cool because you can do a lot of things with cards now that are very specialized, and YouTube highlights that. So you can link to a video or a playlist, of course. You can promote a channel. You can actually solicit a donation. So they have donation partners where if you're a nonprofit or any of that kind of stuff, you can actually have that donation solicitation link built into the video. You no longer have to create a little annotation for it. You can offer a poll question, or you can link to a website that you that is approved. And the approval process for setting up YouTube-approved websites has not changed. You have to go in, you have to prove ownership of the website, all that kind of fun stuff. So you still can't link off to any old random thing. But you can link back to your approved website, which is what I've done in the video that I show. But the poll question is kind of cool, and that's a bit of a new feature. I haven't really played around with it too much. I think they're trying to capitalize on the interactivity that Facebook has kind of built in, because I know Facebook polls are pretty popular. People have, even on Facebook, have started creating their own kind of quote-unquote polls right. by having those live videos where people can react with a certain emoji, and then it bumps up certain stats. I've never participated in one, but they seem to show up on my Facebook page every 5 minutes. So I think YouTube's kind of kept their ear to the ground on what people like. Poll questions are really great interactive elements that are kind of no-brainers for marketers.
Right.
You know, I can see us at Vidyard even using it if we've got a video around using video analytics with marketing automation, and we want to ask people what kind of marketing automation system they have. You know, that's an easy and quick poll question. There's no investment in it from the person because we're not taking any of their data. We're just asking a question, getting a response to it. One thing I forgot to mention about end screens is actually pretty cool, too, is, and I think you can do this with cards as well, is YouTube's actually built a direct integration for crowdfunding campaigns. So you see a lot of videos on YouTube for things like Kickstarter projects or Indiegogo campaigns or GoFundMe campaigns. They've actually created a special card type just for that. I think it shows off a little bit more info than it does if you're just linking to an associated website. I didn't have a Kickstarter campaign that I could link off to try, and I didn't go in and dig around and try and find one just to test it out. But that's an interesting addition, the fact that they are now allowing specific cards and have created specific cards for donations and crowdfunding campaigns. I think we can learn a little bit about what YouTube's kind of target audience for video producers is from that, because if they are creating these customized options, there must be a lot of videos online for nonprofits soliciting donations, and there must be a lot of videos online for people looking to use it as a crowdfunding mechanism.
Absolutely.
So that's kind of new and interesting. I think you build what your customers want, and in that case, there was a specialized enough use case for those two things. And then, of course, the associated website, as always, is just a great way to link to your content. My job now over the next couple of weeks is to go through all of our videos that I had annotations on and switch them up to be cards.
Oh, congratulations for that. I mean, that's about a plum job, right?
It's going to be great.
Hey,
go ahead.
How long do you anticipate that taking? Vidyard's got a lot of videos.
We have a lot of videos. I think it's going to take me a little while. I'll probably do them in batches. I tend to look at what our most viewed videos are and start there and work my way back. It is definitely going to be a process. And I think for any organization that's used annotations quite heavily, I honestly haven't seen much from YouTube around what they intend to do about that. I mean, we have a couple hundred videos, and that's awesome, and it's going to take me a while. Not all of our videos have annotations either. I preach it, but I don't always practice it, especially right. for videos that were uploaded before I got here. I have not gone back and retroactively updated all of our videos with the proper annotations, but, you know, I think if you've been, say, a YouTube video blogger, you know, every single one of your videos has annotations and stuff built into it, there might be a little bit of cleanup to do, and I'm not sure if they have a really good way of automating that process. Maybe as they roll this functionality out and they phase out annotations completely, they do have a plan for it. I haven't seen one yet, but in all honesty, I haven't really looked that hard either. That is one of those tasks that is at the top of my to-do list that I will continue to put off until I absolutely have to, because I dread it a little bit. As you said, we do have quite a few videos, and just about all of them have annotations.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have to go in and figure out how to change all that up and make sure that it all still works.
Hey, John, while you're with me, I want to do a little role play with you. Let's say I've got something like a video series that lives on my site, right? It is how to guarantee your videos generate ROI. And when I post a YouTube video, do I use a YouTube card to then, for my call to action, to bounce people to my approved website's landing page so they can then go and download my welcome series?
I would, yeah. And I think what adds a bit of a layer of complexity in this is, if you're hosting your videos in YouTube and you have those videos on your website, you're really, the impetus is kind of on you now to go in and create a YouTube card. Say you've got a blog series. This is where I'm thinking of it, because we have quite a few videos as blog posts that are part of a series. And if I had those on YouTube, at the end of every video, I would have to go in and create a card that links to the next blog post, not to the next video. Because if it links to the next video, it's going to take them to YouTube. And then they're going to go away from my website,
right?
Which I don't necessarily want them to do. We host everything on our blog in Vidyard. So for us, it's just a matter of, same thing, creating a CTA at the end of it that links them to the next blog post. But I'd be doing that anyway. With YouTube, the difficulty is that extra requirement that on your end screen, you've got a video in there. If somebody clicks on that, they're going to end up back on YouTube. I don't know if, and this is something that I'll have to test out, if you have a video link, say you've got a video embedded on your website, this might get convoluted, say you have a video embedded on your website, your end screen has a link to watch a new video. I'm not sure if you clicking on that link will take you to YouTube or if it will start playing that video inside that player
right in
your blog post. So the question is whether or not they're going to be directed to YouTube or whether or not they're going to be able to stay on your blog and just watch the next piece of video content. I always say it's a good idea to have some kind of CTA at the end of your video, even if it is just watching another video on YouTube. YouTube might be getting the play credits out of that, but at least you know people are continuing to consume your content. And as long as you've got a card somewhere in there that maybe links off to something else, takes people back to your website, takes them to an approved download, whatever it happens to be, then I think you're going to be okay. But it is definitely difficult if you have those videos posted on YouTube, but you have them embedded on your website, because there is a chance now, I think, that those folks might make their way back to YouTube. And if they visited your website, say, through a link off somebody else's blog or through social, it may be really, really hard to keep them on your website.
Yeah.
As somebody who, I go to people's blogs and I read their blogs, and if I bounce out of that page, I'm going to come back to their blog because I already know it exists. If it's a first-time visitor that's watching that video and then bounces their way over to YouTube, they might watch one more of your videos. They might get sucked into the black hole of, funny pug videos and stuff getting crushed by hydraulic presses and all that kind of fun stuff, which is what YouTube is great for.
and
terrible for.
Yeah, absolutely, dude. When I think of YouTube, each one of these social networks and dominant websites, they all have their own kind of personality. The more you get to know them, the YouTube personality to me, that kind of, they base all their decisions on. They're kind of like a bartender that doesn't ever let you want to leave the bar. So as soon as you start to leave, the video player, and you want to like click on something and go somewhere else, even if it's an embed on a website, all of the actions are stay with us, stay with us. Here's another drink. Have you considered vodka? What about a glass of wine? What about a beer? And every time I keep trying to get out of the door, they keep, enticing me to stay and play longer. And that's what happens when you see them roll out things like, end cards and end screens and YouTube cards, is they give me more options to keep me inside of that YouTube environment so I can still continue to grow how long I'm there. And they boost over their overall numbers of advertising and how long somebody's going to have a session.
Oh, of course. And that's definitely their sort of bread and butter. It's the same with Facebook. I mean, Facebook's objective is to keep you on Facebook.
Right.
Instagram's objective is to keep you, even not necessarily keep you on Instagram, but keep you coming back to Instagram. It's okay to close the app as long as you come back to it in a half an hour, because we'll let you know that somebody's broadcasting live. And I'm finding this especially on social networks with live video. I love live video. It's awesome. I've used it at, a variety of different situations. Some of the small businesses that I've worked for and with have had great success with it, taking people behind the scenes. But the difficult part is just that it's very distracting, and every social network now has a new way of kind of throwing it in your face. Facebook tells me, this person's broadcasting live. Instagram pops up a notification now. And it's at a point where I'm going to turn off a lot of the notifications, because as live video gets more prominent, my phone becomes basically a live video streaming device.
Yeah.
And so I think every social network is really committed to keeping you on it, and YouTube is no different. And that's where I saw, you know, that one glaring issue with end screens, which for me is a frustration as a marketer, because I want to make sure that people who are watching my video get to my content. From YouTube's perspective, I totally get it.
You know, when it comes to live, it seems like all of these social networks have incentivized live by giving you a notification access to all of your followers. But once, like what you're talking about, once you hit this saturation point where it starts to become annoying to the people on the platform, and then people have a, you know, common knowledge, you hit some type of a threshold where over 60% of people are using live or aware of live or have interacted with live. Then once you cross that Rubicon line, then the social network goes back to a traditional notification process. And I feel like we're just at the tail end of the prioritizing and promoting live events.
Yeah, I think so too. I think there's a fine line in terms of being helpful and being annoying. And I think this applies to everything, whether you're in sales, whether you're in marketing, sure, whether you're in, you know, customer support, whatever it is, you know, whether you're helping somebody at a retail store, there's always a fine line between helpful and annoying. And I think it's a threshold, you're absolutely right, where when people first start using it, it's very new and exciting, and you get those notifications, and you're like, oh, cool, you know, like Michael Litt is broadcasting a live video, and our CEO is great for that. He does live videos a lot, but only in the context of stuff that's really kind of worth sharing.
Right.
We have a big event here at Vidyard when the Prime Minister was here, which was really cool. You know, he did some live video stuff around that, and it was awesome, and I think that's a great use case of it. I think from a user perspective, there is such a thing as too much of a good thing. So if you're the person who's making live videos, you know, when you're doing live video every 5 seconds, you're kind of detailing every aspect of your life, it's cool and fun to follow along. But everyone else on the end that's getting a notification about it every time you're, you know, I'm live video brushing my teeth in the morning, eventually they're going to start unsubscribing to that. And I think, you know, all it takes is one bad apple to ruin it for everybody in reality. And you know, all it takes is that one person who's broadcasting live every single thing that they do, and you're getting 100 notifications a day that someone's live. And then that person, on my end at least, you know, I've gone in and turned off notifications for live video, so now I'm not seeing anybody's anymore. And I think there is kind of a saturation point where all it takes is one bad apple who abuses this amazing new technology to post a video every time they brush their teeth, you know, every cool thing they do in a given day, they're broadcasting it live. And that's awesome for some, but I don't think we've hit a point yet where social networks have made it really easy to mute specific people and to unsubscribe from updates from specific people, which is kind of a shot in the foot for them, because now I've kind of blanket unsubscribed from all of that, and I might miss something, and that stinks. But really, in that case, to me, it's Facebook's fault for not letting me say, okay, Steve posts way too much, let me just unsubscribe from him really easily from my phone, versus just the notification for unsubscribing from all updates about live video. And now I really only see them when I log into the app. So I do think we're going to kind of hit a saturation point at some point. I think people are going to start kind of getting tired of that overshare, although maybe not. I mean, our culture right now is very, very into overshares. So we may find ourselves just being bombarded constantly with live videos of people brushing their teeth. Who knows? But I think for myself, I very quickly hit a saturation point with it. You know, sure, for every really interesting live video I saw, there were about 100 that were just people talking about nothing or just like showing me them doing something mundane throughout their day. And I just got tired of the notifications all the time. So I went in personally and turned it all off, which means now I might miss one of those really cool updates. But again, it just took a handful of bad apples to kind of get me to deactivate the whole thing. So I don't really know yet what the solution for that is. I think it's a very new technology when it comes to social networks, and we'll have to see what that balance finally looks like.
You know, when I'm speaking now, I'm doing a demo on, you know, live in front of the audience about how to go live on each one of these platforms and what the different nuances and tricks are and what tools you need. And it seems to be, you know, the audience seems to be the most engaged around those topics. And the reason is because it's free. And so, you know, everybody's got budget for free. And so I have to spend some time explaining to them why all your videos can't be live and why your most important videos can't be low production quality. And it's really interesting to me where people come into the video topic, because they all come in from with different levels of sophistication. And it tends to make it a bit of a complex conversation, because, you know, some people just think if it's if it's a live stream and you're having a conversation about your product or service, it's just as good as a highly produced overview video or an explainer video that drills right down to it. So it takes a few moments to unravel that.
Agreed. You know, and I think that goes back to that sort of overshare concept where, you know, it's really cool to show off something live going on in your office, but, you know, not everyone cares about those sort of very mundane details.
Yep.
You know, when we use live video here at Vidyard, it tends to be an event or something really cool is happening.
You guys have purpose.
Or, you know,
there's a reason for
a cool
doing
speaker.
It.
Exactly, yeah. And you know, I think one is that you can overshare, but two, the nice thing about live video, though, and this is to your point of trying to get people excited about using it, is that those notifications and stuff like that, it does seem like social networks are starting to prioritize that live video, which I think is just because they know it's very compelling and they want more people to log into their app. But I think marketers can very much take advantage of that, at least for now, while it's still cool and exciting. You know, and if you've got something really neat, you know, a little plug, I work doing a little bit of volunteer work for a family-run business in Guelph. That's a little craft distillery. The distilling process is really, really cool. People don't tend to know very much about it.
Right.
So when we put up a live video of us even just running the still, it is typically our most popular piece of content because it's really exciting and nobody knows about it. But then we don't go live with some of the more mundane things. I mean, I don't point the camera at our owner when he's like filling out tax forms because I really don't think anybody would care.
Right.
But, you know, when something cool is going on, when something exciting happens, you know, when they were doing their grand opening, we had a little bit of live video and stuff for that too. That stuff's exciting, and it gave people who can't be there a chance to kind of take part. But I think before you press, you know, record on anything, whether it's pressing record on a live video to broadcast it, or even just pressing record in your own studio to make a video, you know why you're making that video and what you want to accomplish with it. Otherwise, you know, I think you've talked quite about this in the past, it's just video for the sake of video.
Right.
And it might work, but chances are it probably won't because there's no real objective at the end of it. So whether it's live or whether it's pre-recorded, I'm always a fan of at least knowing what you want to accomplish with that video and just making sure that you've got that kind of lined ahead of time.
John Spensley is joining me from Vidyard. John, I notice in your bio that you're an amateur longboarder. Is this surfing? I mean, I'm a beach kid. I grew up surfing and skateboarding, or is this skateboard?
That is skateboarding. I wish I lived close enough to a beach to surf, but I don't. So I've been skateboarding since high school. I've been longboarding since my first year of university. I call myself an amateur on it because I do absolutely nothing to get better at it.
Right.
It's something that I do for fun in the evenings and ride around and be happy. So I put amateur in there just so that people don't make any assumptions about my skill level.
What are you riding? What kind of a board?
I think it's a Loaded Dervish, I want to say. So a company out of California, really great. I've nicknamed it the Pink Lady because I got hot pink trucks and hot pink wheels for
it.
And I name all of my skateboards. My old one was all purple, and I called it the Grape Escape. So I like having fun with it. I ride it quite a bit in the summer, especially the city that I live in has recently repaved a lot of its roads, so it's spectacular right now. But I started riding in university largely as just a way to get around. It's a really great way to get from one side of campus to another with very little effort.
Yeah.
And then I kept going at it. And so, So I throw the word amateur in there just as an indication that I do absolutely nothing to get better at it.
You know,
bike riding around.
My homies that I grew up with in Manhattan Beach, they opened Sector 9 Skateboards, which specialize in longboards. I've often thought about getting myself one of those cool Sector 9 boards. But anyway, long story short, dude, really appreciate you spending a few moments with us, breaking down the latest developments at YouTube as they're moving to a more mobile-friendly, mobile-dominant audience. And it's really cool, John, to see the transition take place. Thank you so much for joining us on Video Marketing Mastery.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Looking forward to chatting with you again soon.
And for those of you that want more information, you can always go to vidyard.com. You'll notice as you go into the blog section that John Spensley has a ton of articles that pop up in there. You know, there is the most famous mustache in all of digital marketing, and that goes to Rand Fishkin. But the most famous sideburns are definitely earned by John Spensley. John, thanks again, man.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right, dude, this was a lot of fun. Anytime you've got something that would be of interest to the audience, feel free to hit me up, okay? You're great behind the mic, and I'd love to talk with you further. Okay, have you ever heard of the term freebooting? What is freebooting? Well, freebooting is stealing a video and uploading it to your Facebook page for audience engagement and growth. Well, TechCrunch reports today's update to the Facebook Rights Manager tool that launched last year includes a new option to, quote, claim ad earnings, end quote, on other people's uploaded video that you own. Got it? Well, now the revenue will be sent to the content owner, the creator, instead of the person who uploaded it and stole it. That's a pretty nice feature. That's a nice response to a problem solved in the market by people that work on code for a company, Facebook, who's made it known that they're going to put video as a priority. Good on you, Facebook. It's about friggin' time. Often when I'm speaking in front of an audience, you know, people like to ask me how should they market their business if they're in a boring industry? I get this all the time. It goes something like this. Hey, Todd, your video marketing tips sound all great, but my industry's different. It's super boring. How do you make something interesting that's really about a boring topic? First, I need them to understand that they don't need the video to be super interesting or the video to go viral in order for the video to be a success. Viral videos are entertaining to a large number of people, but those people in many cases don't convert. In fact, viral videos aren't even converting videos. If your industry's boring, like let's say your genetics laboratory, you don't need to educate everybody. You know, you don't need to educate you, me, and Dupree. You only need to be interesting to nerds who like genetics, right? So they're already predisposed to appreciate the topic matter. Those are your target audiences. It allows you to drill down to a very tight niche. So when I saw this live sciences story, I knew we had to chat about it for a moment. Vlogger and doctoral candidate Alex Danis invites YouTube audiences into her lab at Stanford University, offering an insider view of her journey as a graduate student training to work in the field of genetics. Quote, if you've ever wanted to peek behind the scenes at the day-to-day activities of a genetics lab, there's a YouTube channel for that. I'm going to post a sample of Alex's videos. Look, if you're struggling to see how you can turn boring into interesting, the first thing you need to do is just cater to your very specific target audience who already thinks your topic is interesting. And the second thing you should do is look at Alex's videos. She is spot on and crushing it with a very solid strategy. Super cool, super nerdy, but you know what she's doing? She's making it interesting. And literally, I could watch the entire video through, but I'm not her target audience. Her target audience are people that love, eat, sleep, drink, genetics. And she's doing a fabulous job being entertaining. If your industry is boring, maybe you're not the right person to be doing the videos. Somebody who can turn boring into interesting is really the right person to be on camera. Aight? Hey, this week, Team Wirebuzz was in Vegas meeting with dozens of clients on their video strategies and some new prospects. And I noticed one of the CEOs that I've been friendly with over the years making a handful of critical video marketing mistakes. I want to take a few moments. You know, walked up to her booth and I saw that her team was passing out DVDs. Literally, DVDs in a jacket that was wrapped so you knew nobody had opened it before. Now, why is this a bad idea, right? Well, I asked the CEO, "Why? What are you guys doing? Like, why are you guys passing out DVDs?" And she explained, "Hey, that's what our chief medical officer told me he wanted us to do." So because I know her and I've had many conversations, I was like, I was just Todd being Todd. I go, "All right, level with me. How old is your chief marketing officer?" She said 70. And then I pulled out my computer and I basically I just turned my computer around on all different sides of my MacBook Pro and said, only 70-year-olds have DVD players today. Like, I literally forbid her for passing out DVDs. Now, wouldn't it be better if you could track who's watching your videos, I said? Wouldn't that be more valuable to your company than just handing out DVDs that are going to end up in somebody's bag and then eventually in the back of their closet, which they're going to throw out? Wouldn't it be more tactical if you were actually gathering emails from prospects visiting your booth and then sending them follow-up emails with your videos in it, so you could prioritize who's the most interested in buying by evaluating their attention span. And, you know, while they're watching the videos, you're tracking on the back end. So you know that if somebody watches a video to completion or watches 80% of a video, that they're a much more interested buyer than somebody who didn't watch it at all. Wouldn't that be more valuable to your company? And wouldn't it be more valuable to your sales team if they could be more efficient? Yesterday's solutions might not be today's most efficient tactic, right? And then I pointed out that her booth had a video in it, and that booth loop video was blurry. I'm like, I think it's a little bit out of date. It just looks like, as I'm looking at it, I'm blinking my eyes. And she said, oh, no, that was done by design. You see, I asked my video creator to make it a little more glossy so it wouldn't show my age. So glossy translates to blurry, right? I want you to know that she is gorgeous, okay? Sure, she's maybe another 10 or 15 years older than me, but flat out frigging Charlie's Angel gorgeous, right? And if you can't get over, if you're a CEO of a company and you can't get over how you look, and that's going to be an impediment to the quality you're going to demonstrate, there's a bigger problem here. Most people don't look like Charlie's Angels, right? And most people aren't as lucky to step in front of the camera and to look like a friggin' rock star. So my little tip for all of you is disconnect your brain from how you look. Stop judging yourself and start recognizing that the quicker you get in front of the camera, the quicker you start telling the story of your business, or you start sharing how your business can help people make more money, the faster you're going to generate revenue. And the more revenue you generate, the more plastic surgery you can get so you can look great on camera, right? It's just how it's done. It's the American way. People are going to judge your product or your service by the visual quality of your videos. We're in a vetting era. So make sure that you get people really good information. You display it in a very high quality format so they can start thinking about your product instead of thinking of the limitations of how you're representing it. Aight? All right, my homies, this is the big wrap-up of episode 84. Listen, you want an easy way to remember 84? You want an easy way to go back and look at the show notes and some of the other resources that we're going to make available? I have literally been waiting for episode 84. Why? 1984 was a really awesome, special year in my life. I was growing up in Los Angeles. We had the Olympics. It was big time. The whole world was focused on my hometown, and LA, for the first time and maybe the only time in its history, we were all worried about smog and pollution and traffic. Like, everybody that lived in LA in 1984 disappeared that weekend. People were getting around on the freeway. The smog was gone. The news was talking about how beautiful LA was. I love it. 1984, beautiful year in my life. Wirebuzz.com/84 is where you'll find the show notes for this episode. All right, so I brought you up to speed about how the free market system and entrepreneurs solve the problem that people have been grappling with for the last couple of weeks about live crime videos and what solutions are in play. I talked to you about Snapchat and how they have some really interesting mobile partnerships, and they've accelerated their partnerships way past where Facebook and Twitter are. I told you about Twitter's biggest nightmare. His name is Donald Trump. How to market to teens. We talked about what's next and how YouTube has retired annotations. And our man John Spenceley from Vidyard dropped into the house to break down annotations and end cards and all that good stuff. Look, if you want to know how to use video to guarantee ROI, my biggest recommendation is to go to wirebuzz.com/ROI. And that's where you can access our 5-part mini course where yours truly is explaining the secrets to using video to guarantee ROI. That's what it's all about. That's where the rubber meets the road. That's where each and every one of your bosses are going to hold me accountable at the end of the day, that if you end up having me do your videos, it's a demonstration of the power of video, but most importantly, an acknowledgement that the videos are great for entertaining. They're even better when they start generating ROI. And that's what we focus on. If you want to get access to it, just go to wirebuzz.com/ROI. And if you want to figure out what are the right topics for your business, you want, we create a topic selection worksheet where you can walk through and start to list out the topics that would be beneficial to your business and help you generate revenue faster. You can get that at wirebuzz.com/topics. Now, if this episode was valuable, share it with a colleague in the cubicle next to you or that friend back east that you're rooting for and you want to see their business succeed. Make sure you share the episode. You subscribe at iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Oh, and while you're there, leave a really honest rating and review. Talk about this podcast and the value that it brings to you and your business and makes you a more complete and compelling marketer. I'd really appreciate that. And behind the scenes, me and my team will continue to source the latest news in video marketing and bring it back to you with some smart, important business takeaways that you can use to naturally make your business more profitable. At the end of the day, our goal with this podcast is to give you really compelling information because we know that we can connect the dots and turn you into a video marketing master.